Machines That Fail Us, a podcast by the Media and Culture Research Group at the University of St. Gallen about the human rights implications of AI errors and failures and our future with artificial intelligence. This is the fourth episode of Season 2 of Machines That Fail Us. I am Philip DiSalvo, a researcher and lecturer at the University of St. Gallen, where I'm part of the Media and Culture Research Group within the Institute for Media and Communications Management. I'm also the host of this podcast, so welcome back to the show. In this episode, we focus on the arts, particularly visual arts, and explore their interconnections with artificial intelligence, generative AI, and the evolving discourse surrounding the perceived fallacies of AI. Generative AI has shown the impressive capabilities of machines in creating images and other visual content. The rise of AI tools such as Midjourney, DALL-E, and others has shaken the arts at various levels. With machines showing these capabilities, how is art going to change? Are Gen AI-generated images showing any form of aesthetic values, for instance? How should they be integrated into the creative process? These are just some of the questions being discussed right now, while issues such as copyright and authorship are being reconsidered once more. Many conversations so far have focused on hallucinations, the uncanny and sometimes bizarre, yet erroneous outcomes of generative AI. What do these images tell us about how machines create content and about the process of generating imagery from data? At the core of the issue lies the question of whether AI is capable of creating anything at all, or whether it is simply reassembling training data, data that is usually collected by technology companies in opaque and unfair ways. In various creative industries, legitimate fears about machines taking over human tasks are echoing. At the same time, though, social media being flooded with what has been called AI slop, a deluge of AI-generated images that are polluting the internet with algorithmically optimized content, while also raising intriguing aesthetic questions. While these problems are real and pressing, coming to terms with creative machines should also involve looking in another direction, trying to illuminate what AI can tell us about the future of art and other visual fields. For this episode of Machines That Fail Us, I'm very happy to host Valentina Tanni. Tanni is an art historian, curator, and lecturer based in Rome, Italy. Her research focuses on the relationship between art and technology, with particular attention to web cultures. She teaches meme culture and aesthetics, digital media culture, and introduction to visual culture at John Cabot University in Rome. In the past, she has also taught at La Sapienza University of Rome, the Polytechnic University of Milan, and NABA, New Academy of Fine Arts, both in Rome and Milan. She is the author of many international books about these issues, and her latest one is titled Conversazioni con la macchina, il dialogo dell'arte con le intelligenze artificiali, and has been published in Italy by Tlon earlier this year. The translation of the book is Conversations with Machines, the dialogue between arts and artificial intelligence. Valentina, thanks for joining Machines That Fail Us. It's great to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
So my first question for you really starts from your latest book, and I would like to ask you, how is AI kind of part of visual arts today? How is it part of this landscape? Is it more considered as a tool, a collaborator, or something else entirely, maybe?
It's not easy to answer the question because it's a very kind of broad issue. Because if you think about it, the terms of the problem, like we have art on one side and AI on the other side, these two things can be very different. They're not like easy to grasp as concepts. Like when we use the word art, for example, we can associate with the word so many different things. And it's a concept that is very like culturally situated, right? And even in the context of the same culture, it can be perceived differently among different communities of people. AI is also an umbrella term. We talk about AI as a single technology, but it's not. Like it's like this very wide field of research, and it includes so many different technologies and applications and approaches, right, to this idea of building intelligent machines. So you can understand that when people ask me to comment on the relationship between AI and art, it's always very visual art specifically here. it's very difficult to kind of narrow, to pin down exactly what we're talking about. But to try to answer nonetheless, the thing is that AI is being used in so many different ways among different communities of artists. So sometimes it is, it's mostly a tool. Like, so it is used to maybe reproduce existing styles, existing aesthetics, and to kind of maybe just make some certain processes faster, like to kind of optimize certain kind of processes. But I think that the most interesting experiments are instead trying to use the machine as an entity with which you can enter in a dialogue. And that's why in my latest book, I talk about conversations with machines, because I think that it's interesting when the human side enters in a conversation with the machine, because it kind of like the final output is like most of the time is more interesting. Like it's not just about asking the machine to do something on your behalf, right? I mean, the output can be sometimes even like good. Like it can be good. There are some instances in which you can still produce interesting output just asking the machine to do things for you, because of course it depends a lot on the prompt and what you're looking for. But I think that it gets really interesting when you let the conversation flow. And so there's this feedback going on between you and the machine. And from that conversation, you can get things that you wouldn't be able to get otherwise.
And that's also at the core of the book, which is titled Conversations with the Machine. And I'm really interested about this point of collaborate with AI in a sort of co-authorship in creating visual arts and arts in general. And you discuss a lot of this master-servant model in the book that we must look beyond. And I totally agree with you on that. What's that about, and how is that also connected with other discourses with AI taking over and substituting humans, all of that?
Yeah, the need to write that really started from the need to debunk or question that paradigm, right? So the so-called master-slave paradigm, in the sense that we human beings in general, also if you look back at history, we have been trying to build machines that are intelligent and build machines that can rival us on many fields, right? Like we really want to kind of transfer our skills to the machine. And we model machines after us in a way, right? Because like human intelligence is, it's the kind of intelligence that we know a little bit more about. We don't know everything about human intelligence yet, but it's the kind of intelligence that we maybe know a little bit more about. And we try to transfer our kind of intelligence and to kind of make the machine able to perform certain tasks that we associate with the concept of intelligence in general. It's an old dream in human civilization, this idea of building automata and robots and like machines that can kind of simulate human intelligence and human behavior. So on the one hand, we have this dream. But on the other hand, we are also kind of really scared, right, about the possibility of machines taking over. And these two things are always co-present in the history of the relationship between humans and machines. So the machine is our slave. So the machine is good as long as we can control it. But if the machine gets maybe in the future more intelligent, more capable, and we kind of, for some reason, we lose control over machines, then of course it's the singularity and the apocalypse and so on, right? This is also a big trope in science fiction. So we are kind of imbued with this idea and we have been told these stories for decades and centuries maybe, right? So the master-slave paradigm that I mentioned in the book is this idea of always framing AI in a sort of confrontational way. So it's either us or the machine, right? And that is not useful. And also, I think maybe even dangerous. Something that I also talk about in the book is the fact that a lot of companies, like big technological companies that are working with AI, that they are building this narrative that AI is dangerous. But that is, I mean, in a way, it's a marketing strategy in the sense that if the machine is so dangerous, it's also very, very powerful, right? And so if you can convince the investors that that technology is so powerful that can, for good and bad, can kind of really disrupt everything that we know in our human culture, then you get more funds. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that there are no risks associated, right? Because of course there are, but it's not that kind of sci-fi scenario that they are always kind of trying to fit into people. So in the book, what I try to do is to kind of leave that paradigm behind. I mean, I'm an art historian, that's my background. And so I start from like take art as my starting point to kind of question that kind of paradigm. In fact, the entire book is about artists that have been looking beyond this idea of, I don't know, have this specific relationship with the machine, like with this oppositional, right, attitude to the machine. And so it's about the dialogue. And I start from the 1950s, because another idea that I had in mind, another goal of the book is also to regain some historical perspective and kind of remind people that, yes, of course, we are living in a kind of so-called summer of AI. So there's a lot of hype and a lot of new tools, but it's not entirely new. It's not something that we have not been experimenting with in the past. And so I think that artists have like a different approach. They have this kind of lateral approach or maybe alternative approach to technology. They're not really trying to build tools that work. And so they are kind of more free to experiment. And so they really open conversations with the machine.
And as you know, the podcast is mostly about the role of errors by artificial intelligence and machines. And there's been lots of discussions around hallucinations of generative AI and what do they entail in terms of the outcomes. And those has been mostly visual in particular. So a lot of these images kind of weird with mistakes from what we would expect. So I wonder whether you see some artistic value in that or some artistic intent maybe in those images. And I know that hallucinations is a controversial term. I don't like it either. But I wonder what's your take on that?
Yeah, artists, especially in the past century, century and a half, artists have been working a lot with errors. Like this has been a big topic and a big point of interest for contemporary art, right? For modern art, for avant-garde art. So like investigating error and chance is something that artists have been working with for more than a century now. So it didn't came as a surprise that a lot of artists, they really got interested and they have been fascinated by the idea of exploring the errors of the machine and the hallucination of the machine and all the instances in which the machine is not really understanding the task entirely or is not really understanding the world entirely. Because this is what we see happening a lot in AI when it comes to visual output. So generative AI that produces images. Of course, generative AI tools, they are progressing and they are getting better and better. And this is why we get less and less errors. But in the beginning, it was all about errors. Like the first artistic projects that made use of AI, it was mainly GANs, so generative adversarial networks, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. And artists working with GANs, they were all working on this idea of the machine dreaming, the machine hallucinating, the machine producing these kind of weird, uncanny images. So at the beginning, AI was mostly used exactly for that, because it was understanding the world, not entirely. So it was this liminal space, right, between reality and dreams, reality and imagination. And so at the beginning, it was all about that, right? Like the first few years. Now AI is evolving and some of these tools are getting quote unquote better, because it depends on like the point of view, but they are getting better at understanding what they see and reproducing reality as we know it. So it's getting more and more difficult to get those errors. So artists that are interested in that are trying, like they are having a hard time like breaking the locks and really pushing the machine to its limits to get those errors again. But there are also interesting examples that are not only related to the use of text-to-image applications, so where the final output is not immediately the image, but also with the text. For example, a couple of years ago, I curated an exhibition of an Italian artist. His name is Roberto Fassone, and he has been training his own generative AI model on psychedelic trips, like a database of trip reports, right? So people that have been taking LSD and other psychedelic drugs, and they have been writing down their experiences and what they've been seeing and feeling, right, and so on. And he built his own, with the help of an engineer, his own generative model that was able to generate new trip reports. So this idea, metaphorically speaking, mm-hmm, was to kind of feed psychedelic drugs to the machine, right? And what happened is that, of course, like, this specific kind of model was hallucinating more than usual. And so it was producing a lot of incredible and absurd kind of content. But what the artist did, what Roberto did, was that a few times he encountered, for example, in this text, music album titles or film, like movie titles. Of course, these movies and these albums were non-existent. But what he did, yeah, and that was, I think, a great idea, was to take those ideas and make them a reality. So, for example, there was, yeah, this rap artist that was popping up in this text, and he recorded an entire music album, right, that was non-existent, mm-hmm, attributing that album to that artist and so on. So there's also this idea of like taking this hallucination and kind of bringing them onto the plane of reality. This is just one example, but there are other examples, yeah, that are similar. Like, for example, also when you see people that are producing images that are supposed to be screenshots from movies that are non-existent, right? And that's also, mm-hmm, an interesting way of exploring this idea of parallel realities, right? So yeah, artists are having a lot of fun with this kind of so-called errors. Yeah.
Okay. And my other question for you is about the political economy dimension of generative AI, which is quite under scrutiny when it comes to journalism, for instance, or social sciences. And I wonder whether there is a similar discourse also in arts. So how is that kind of critique emerging from visual arts, for instance? Do you think it's a topic of discussion also in that field?
Yes, of course. This is a topic of discussion in every field. And I think that, I mean, if you take the issue seriously, you cannot really escape that part of the issue. Because, of course, the entire field has been monopolized, right, by a few giant corporations. And so it's really important that people know what's in the background, like what's happening beyond the interface that we use, right? So yes, this is an issue. Like, the political, economical, and also ecological issues are discussed in the art field so much. And mm-hmm, in addition to that, there's also a very wide discussion about copyright and intellectual property, because of course this is something that kind of really impacts the art field in a very specific way. But yes, a lot of artists are, like, some of them are kind of incorporating this discussion in the work, meaning that they are producing work that kind of is a question, right? That kind of embodies the question. Think about, I don't know, Trevor Paglen, for example.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of artists doing that. Also, Olly Herndon and Matt Dreyers, they are working on that a lot, but the list is very long. Like, a lot of artists are kind of really incorporating all these discussions in the work itself, but also when this is not the case, like artists that are working just with AI to produce maybe images or videos or sounds, a lot of them are advocating for a more sustainable technology. They are advocating for regulation for those companies that are kind of building the tools, and also, of course, advocating for more rights when it comes to training, right? So the data that is used to train these machines, that comes from the most, like, from all sources. Like, there's this going back to Olly Erdon and Matt Dreyes, the title of their last publication is All Media is Training Data, right? Because this is exactly what is happening right now. So yes, the discussion is pretty much alive in the art field as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned copyright, and that's also something I had on my list. And of course, we know that copyright is malfunctioning by itself for quite a few time now. So how do you see that into this conversation? I mean, because I see that the issue is being mostly coped with in publishing and in journalism, but how is that also related to the art field?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult because my generation, like, we have been fighting against copyright all our lives, right? So it's a it's a really weird situation because the tables have turned all of a sudden. Yes. So in a way, of course, I still think that copyright as we have it right now is outdated and should be revised. And especially in the field of art, I am generally speaking against it, right? I'm all for appropriation, and that's, like, philosophically speaking, that's my thing. And also, I have been advocating for access to information in general and freedom of like circulating information, sharing information. Like, those are my values, right? But the information landscape and the whole situation has changed, like, drastically. So we are now in a situation in which the companies are acting like pirates, right? So they are kind of really stealing.
Yes.
Yeah. But there's a fundamental difference in the sense that when we, I'm using the we very widely, like, people advocating for the abolition of copyright, all the reformation of copyright, we were advocating for this specific right because we were thinking about sharing knowledge. So it was for the common good. Right. So it was not for the gain of the companies. Exactly. Now these companies are trying to kind of, they are faking some interest in this idea of fair use and sharing, but it's not their values. So it's really annoying, the fact that we have been kind of seeing our values twisted like that. Right. So it's very difficult. It's a very difficult issue. I read an article that you wrote, right, recently about this, and it was really on point. So, like, generally speaking, I think that copyright must be reformed, and that's an old issue. But on the other hand, it's important that we understand who is using the material and for what. Right.
Exactly.
That's a question that we cannot lose track of, right? So it's a very complicated issue. Like, maybe, I don't know, I don't have a solution. I think no one has a solution for this problem, but for sure we should keep pushing for more open softwares and open data and open processes, and we should keep asking for regulation in general. Having said that, I still think that copyright is not a solution per se.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because this whole situation involves, for example, labor rights, right? And and that is not something that we can solve through copyright. This is also something that Cory Doctorow says a lot, and I am totally with him on it. Like, we tend to overestimate copyright laws, like, and what these laws can actually do, because we have been seeing, like, in the past, we have been also observing, and we can also say that copyright most of the time tends to work in advantage of the people that have already a lot of power and money. Sorry. So it's not really, like, in principle, it might look like it's defending people's rights, but it's not always the case.
Exactly, yeah. And you mentioned my article, thanks for that. That was related to the academic publishing, which is probably even more complicated because there are more layers of power involved. But I see that the conversation is absolutely in early stages in pretty much every field. And the changes you mentioned are absolutely sea changes, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
My last question for you today, it's about the phenomenon of AI slop, which has been kind of appearing all around social media over the past few months. And you're also, like, an expert in internet aesthetics. So I wonder what's your idea about AI slop, because usually it's used as a kind of negative term to criticize this deluge of content produced by generative AI. But do you see any interesting take out of AI slop?
Yeah. So it really depends on the point of view, right? Because there is a fascinating side of this phenomenon, because as we were mentioning a minute ago, AI slops sometimes can get hilarious, like because the machine is just producing crazy stuff. And also, since the weirder the image, the higher the engagement, right? So people that are trying to make some money from it, they are trying to produce weirder and weirder images just to get people clicking and commenting, right? Yeah. So there's this mechanism going on. But if we look at it from a purely aesthetical point of view, it's really interesting. Like there's this kind of avalanche of weird content that it's kind of being produced 24 hours a day. And sometimes it's fascinating. It has like this weird side that from the point of view, like for me that I study aesthetics, it holds some power, right? Also because again, the machine is making a lot of errors and also is kind of twisting reality in some unexpected ways. Mm-hmm. But of course, there are a lot, there are downsides to it. And because we are really polluting the internet, like literally. Yeah. We are really flooding the web with content that is inaccurate and it's sometimes just plain false. So this is going to generate it's already happening, but it's going to generate a lot of confusion in the future. And the more these models, they kind of get better at simulating, for example, real photographs, but also simulating like human text, it will get harder and harder in the future to really kind of distinguish fake from real or generated from human made. And maybe this is something we are destined to abandon forever. Like we are not going to be able to make those distinctions anymore. So, and I don't know what the consequence of this will be, but this is happening. So there is an interesting side of the so-called AI slop, but also it is a very worrying issue on the other hand. Yeah. We are kind of floating the web with spam, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So there is the downside of it. But there are also, you were mentioning the fact that I'm interested in internet aesthetics. This is true. I'm interested in a very specific kind of slop that maybe we shouldn't call that slop. I don't know, but a lot of people are calling that slop too. That it's when people are appropriating these technologies to produce, for example, memes or stories. Think about this amazing trend of Italian brain rot that is going on.
Ah, yes.
Like that is technically slop, right? But it's technically slop, like in the sense that it is using, like they're using the same techniques and the same aesthetic of Shrimp Jesus. That's the same aesthetic. Right? The same aesthetic and the same philosophy and the same technology, but it's not the same content in the end. And that content has not the same sense. Right. In that case, that kind of slop is building like a collective mythology, collective narratives and collective stories. And so you can see that it really depends on what you do with the technology itself. Even when you are staying inside the frame of the same aesthetic, it's not the same thing. It's about the function. Right. And so if you are producing, again, a weird image, the Shrimp Jesus kind of thing, because your goal is just to get views and likes, that's one thing. But you can produce the same weird image, but play with it and involve other people in remixing the image and commenting the image. And so that becomes a common piece of culture, right?
Yeah.
And that's when the human part comes in.
Yeah. And that's also a very great way for closing this conversation, not with a machine, but between the two of us for the time being. So, Valentina, thanks a lot for joining Machines That Fail Us.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
The Machines That Fail Us podcast is produced by the Media and Culture Research Group at the Institute of Media and Communications Management at the University of St. Gallen, together with the Communications Department of the University. The post-production is curated by Podcast Schmiede. The next episode of the podcast will be released next month. You can listen to all the episodes of Machines That Fail Us on the University of St. Gallen website, the Human Error Project website, and all major audio and podcasting platforms. This is Philip DiSalvo, and on behalf of the entire Media and Culture Research Group, thank you for listening.